and I love him, and I'd like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Clancy Eye.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm very glad to be here tonight. Now I just start setting the record right. I never said that I led a choir at the Texas Nut House, ever. I never did. I directed a Christmas pageant. Not a very complex one, but the director's main job was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly could. Get back, Lamar, back. But I'm happy to be here tonight. I just think that's the 18th trip I've made down here for this meeting. And I must say that this accommodation is considerably better than that hideous mechanics hall we used to be at. Although I got to like it after a while. I got to know all the plaques on the wall. But this has really got a little more pizzazz to it. I hate to get off on the wrong foot, but I am compelled to do this. Bill Wilson in heaven has asked me to do this on a continuing basis, so I'm going to do it. About 35 years ago in the San Fernando Valley, there's an old guy at the Canoga Park meeting named Bill Davidson, and he was kind of an old fanatic. And he was just he had strong ideas about things. One of his ideas that everyone in AA should be anonymous, not only anonymous to the level of press, radio, and films, but from each other. Just nobody should know anybody. And what he would do when they would read the traditions, he would echo the last phrase. You see, hear that? Principles before personalities. They say, oh, shut up, Bill. Not going to shut up. Beastly said. Then three or four young guys, one of whom I sponsored, I didn't know it at the time, but they would mock him. He'd say, principles before personalities. Is that right, Bill? Shut up. Not going to shut up. Beastly said. You know, it's got to be a joke. And finally, some boob from the Sylvan and Cedros group came over there to talk one night and heard this and thought it was some sort of a spiritual breakthrough they had and took it back and told his group we should all join in and say principles before personalities. And so they did. And for about 25 years, in the central San Fernando Valley, there were about four groups who used to chant principles before personalities. None of them ever knew why. And anybody go out there to speak? Well, we're going to speak tonight. We'll speak for the chanters, you know. It was kind of a laugh, which was all right. It's nice to have a little microcosm of inanity in the middle of the San Fernando Valley. But then some other cork got out of the bottle, and the wind carried the microbes around the countryside. And now there's any sort of number of meetings. This was one tonight for principles before personalities. Not only that, but they ended in Chapter 5 for no reason whatsoever. God could and would have thought. They probably would join in the end of the promises, too, if they knew what they were. But it really serves no purpose. There's a lot of these. In fact, here's the irony of it all. The Canoga Park meeting, where it started, part of the format is the secretary asked the meetings not to chant, because it has no meaning whatsoever. So where it started, they don't do it anymore, and a lot of places they don't. Our group in West Los Angeles, there's over 1,000 people every Wednesday night. When they read it, they read it. There's nobody joining in, because it has no purpose whatsoever. So I'm down here tonight to talk to some of you. Some of you people who've probably been here quite a long time, 5-6 months, you're probably set in your ways. There's no sense trying to convert you. Oh, I got my way. Screw him, you know. But if you're new, some of the guys your first 30 days, Jeffrey and some of the others, if you're just new, before you've gone down the wrong path, you don't have to chant. It's done nowhere else in the country. It's done nowhere else in the world. It's done in Southern California amongst certain groups, and not one person who chants knows why. Why do you chant? So all I'm saying, you don't have to chant. It's not part of AA. And nobody in our row chanted this evening. Because if you do chant, you're not doing anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. You're merely mocking Bill Davidson in the Canoga Park meeting. And he's been dead for 18 years, for Christ's sake. That's all.
Is there anything else I want to say before I sit down?
I used to drink alcohol, and I drank it for a long time, but I never paid much attention to it. I grew up in a little town up in northern Wisconsin, a little town called Eau Claire. And in fact, I was at a little class dinner earlier today in Malibu. I wanted to get to drive as far in the rain as I possibly could. So I drove to Malibu in the rain so I could come all the way to San Diego from Malibu. And there's a little class there in our group. It's a very large group. So all the people who got sober in a given year get together and have a little dinner. And this was the class of 1995. There were about 35 of them having a dinner. And in that 35, three of them were from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is some kind of a record for a small Midwestern town. And they're all goofy. When I grew up in this little town, and I was raised in something called the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Most of you have never heard of the Norwegian Lutheran Church because it isn't big in this area. I'm a Norwegian, and people say, isn't that wonderful? But it really isn't. I'll tell you. Let me tell you what the Norwegian is like. I can tell you in one small example. I was talking in Oslo a couple of years ago, and they took me up to 100 miles north or so where my grandfather and some of his little brothers jumped left there. A whole bunch of Norwegians left in the 1880s to come to the United States to get out of that terrible climate, to get to comfortable climate. Then they came over. They all settled in North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they spent the last 100 years up there saying, Jesus, it's cold up here too, you know. That's the kind of mindset I have to start with, that I've had to fight to overcome it. But it's a very, very strong religion. You only have two rules, as far I could tell when I was a little boy. A very strict church is because you don't sin and you don't talk to Catholics. Seems reasonable if you want to go to heaven. But I was kind of a nervous and restless kid, and I found out later in psychoanalysis that the Norwegian Lutheran Church had repressed me. Remember, I had tears in my eyes thinking, if they only know. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. But when I was 15, the Second World War started, and I was nervous and restless. And one day I told my mother I want to go up to Superior, Wisconsin, and visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me my little suitcase and gave me some money for bus fare. And I got a ride from a guy to Minneapolis, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea where the hell I was going, just to San Francisco. I remember standing outside of Minneapolis. Already I was further than I'd ever been away from home. This was 100 miles. I knew the hitchhikers. I'd ask them questions. You stand on the highway, and you say, nice stuff. And the car stopped, and I said, where are you going, kid? San Francisco. He said, so am I. Hop in. And away we went. Turned out he was in the Navy, going back to a ship. And, God, I didn't know anything was going on. And we'd travel for, you know, 1,000 miles. And at night, there weren't any motels. There were trailer courts. He'd stop and get me a bed and get him a bed. And he bought my meals and listened to me talk and talked to me. And I guess he just wanted somebody to help him keep awake all this whole trip. And I've thought about that many times. Said, you know, I had no idea. I've never hitchhiked. I just thought, you tell people where you're going and they take you there. You know, what do I know? As we get to San Francisco, I told him I was going to be in the Marines and go over there and kill Japs. And he said, you're really kind of small. You know, I was about this big, then a face full of pimples. He said, you probably wouldn't get the Marines or anything else at the moment, but they're crying for merchant marine guys. I'll tell you what, you go to the Coast Guard office. I'll show you how to get there. Tell them you want to be in the merchant. Tell them you're 16 for sure, not 15. And see if it happens. So he let me off. I remember going to the Coast Guard office the first morning I was in San Francisco. And I said, I want to be in the merchant marine. Guy handed me some applications. Fill out this application, kid. I put down 16. You're only 16. You'll need your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And I brought it back, and tell you how desperate they were. They issued me Siemens papers right there. My training was walking around the block. And he said, well, okay, but these are temporary. You'll get some permits in the mail later. Wait, they're crying for men down the National Maritime Union. Get down there right now. Some showed me how to get to the National Maritime Union, and down Montgomery Street, my little bag, and had me sign a check, saying, or a waiver saying, take me union dues out of my next check, wherever that was. Guy said, hop in the car, kid, quick. And they drove me and another guy over to the Embarcadero, and says, here's your ship, get on it quick, they need two guys. And I got this enormous ship, and I just got aboard, and they raised the gangplank, and away we went to the South Pacific. It's kind of funny for a while. You know, guys say, there's Treasure Island. That's where the World's Fair was last year. That's Alcatraz over there. That's where all the big gangsters go. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. But the damn ship just kept going. And pretty soon the Earth was going out of sight. I was standing there on the deck watching it. And I think I had an intuitive feeling that I'd made the first in an endless series of career errors. Some guy came by and said, hey, you get your fo'c'sle. Hi, Kenny. And I said, no, hi, Kenny. He didn't say, hi, Kenny. I just saw Kenny back there. Hi, Kenny. Raise your head and wave your hand, you dummy. Anyway, I hate to see him doze off so early in the talk. He's probably the only man in this room or any man that anybody here knows that was present the first day I walked into AE in Los Angeles. No front teeth and nothing going. And he ridiculed me, son of a bitch. Anyway. But I've forgotten it. It's only been 40 years. But I said, get your fo'c'sle. I don't know what a fo'c'sle was. It sounded ominous to me. Of course, a fo'c'sle is just a sleeping quarters on a ship, as most of us know. And I got this room. They called it a cabin. It looked like a room to me. And had three of the worst type of people that a small, dumb, Norwegian Lutheran, pimply-faced puke could ever be with. And these kind of people are called men. And they said, what the hell are you supposed to be? I didn't know quite what to tell them. And I look back, I know why they were so upset at the moment. I didn't know at the time, but there were four-man deck crews. I was the fourth man of their four-man deck crew. And they looked at me and they realized they were going to be doing their work and mine for the rest of that trip. You know? And why'd you get your damn bunk? So I did. And that ship was moving around like this, and God, I was so... I started to get a little seasick and it's hot in there. And I wanted my mother is what I really wanted. But I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. Then these guys got talking and I couldn't believe my ears. My God. They'd been in San Francisco apparently for several days and they'd been doing things with women that you wouldn't. I'm a Lutheran. I couldn't... I leaned over and I said, I realized, of course, I should have known it. They all got black hair, Catholics. Right? And I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive and I'd been afraid and I'd been alone. These guys were doing it with people, if you could imagine that. And I just had to tell you that was a terrible start. And then, but I hung around. I was dumb. After a couple of days, I found my role on the ship. And every ship, I guess, has one, or every military unit. The ship fool, you know. After I got to know my way around, hey, ship, go down the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, look at the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. On and on. One day, these guys used to sit around, and they all had carried their whiskey in their sea bags. They weren't supposed to, but they did because they were very loose. And one day, a guy turned to me and says, hey, Junior, you think you're man enough for a little snort? And he shoved that bottle in my face, and I drew the line there. Because I may be dumb, but I'm not a sinner, and I'm not a Catholic. And I couldn't think what to say. I just, you know, when you get under a lot of emotional stress, you choke up. You know, well, look at the Padres. But I'm a veteran. Anyway. Okay, the Chargers, is that better? For those Clippers you sent us, see? Anyway. But I have a tendency under emotional stress to choke up where you can't even talk. I can just feel my pimple standing up. But I was preparing my mind, I was going to tell him, I was going to say, how dare you put that in my mouth, that's my face, I'm a Lutheran, I promised my mother I'm not going to drink, I don't do that sort of thing, what the heck's wrong with you, leave me alone. I was just about to say that when he said, you want a little snort? And I heard a voice say, God damn right. turned out I'm a little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle of whiskey I was ever close to. And it burned my throat, and burned my mouth, and burned my stomach, and burned my throat, and burned my mouth, and burned his shirt. So I thought, get the bottle away, little son of a bitch. God, I don't know to this day anything that is more painful than public humiliation. That makes people kill people, right? If I had a gun, I'd have shot him. If I'd have been bigger, I'd have smashed him. I didn't hit him. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard, but I might have. Lean over, you. Yeah. Take that. Give him one in the old eye just to teach him a lesson. As we continued across the Pacific, every day I'd sneak into that guy's sea bag sooner or later and try to take a drink of that stuff. So I wanted, and I'd throw it up and I'd have to wipe it up so they wouldn't know. And I hated it, but I so desperately wanted to be accepted by these people. God, I've done that all my life. I just wanted to be accepted, be a thought of man. I had no idea that wouldn't do it. But as we were coming into Pearl Harbor, they were still digging up ships off the bottom. And I was down there taking another drink the day before my 16th birthday. I had a drink of this crap and went down to my stomach and stayed there. That's the first day I didn't throw up a drink of whiskey. And then I couldn't breathe. I thought, why did I do this? And all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I didn't pay much attention to it. I just remember the reaction. Because when you're in your teens is when you learn most of the things you learn about life. And you just learn new things. You don't think, oh, what's a breakthrough? You know, I've always envied people who've had great insights. I've never had insights. I just stumbled through. In fact, new people tonight, you'll hear me talking knowledgeably about my life as though I knew where I was going. That's what speakers do. Yes, I can see what it's, huh? At the time, it's just like a blind man running through the woods. But later you get to age. And then in 1951, I realized I needed to run into an elm tree. I heard a guy say a few years ago, he said, when I held that first drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience with many flowers and fruits to be savored in the coming years until I left that garden to come to this wonderful program. I thought, God damn it, I wish I'd known that. All I ever learned was, if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. But I learned to smoke on that ship. Nobody I knew smoked, but they all smoked. So I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And one day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. Until I realized I was going bald. I want to say something. I said this before, but I want to say it one more time because I think about it. In California now, I haven't been able to smoke there, but a few years ago they took out part of my vocal cord for a different reason. But he said, you get short of your vocal cord, you better not smoke anymore. And I was able to stop. He had told me 20 times that I might die if I kept smoking. It stopped me. But he implied I might go mute. I mean, now we're getting down to the facts. But I'm still a smoker at heart, and I detest the way the state of California treats smokers. You can't smoke anywhere. You drive down the street in rain, as I did today, huddled outside the buildings. A bunch of lepers that should have carry a belt. Unclean. 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 Not only that, but prying goofs feel they have the right to come up to you and denounce you for smoking. Strangers. They were doing that my last year of smoking, a few of them. And I just wanted to say, go get screwed, leave me alone. I finally thought of an answer, and then I had to stop smoking. But for any smokers in this room, I'm going to give you a tool that if you use it wisely, you'll be thankful to me as long as you live. I'll guarantee you that they will never ask you why you smoke again. I think I'm saying, why do you smoke? Here's an answer that will stop. Why do I smoke? I have a feeling that one of these days they'll find a market for phlegm and I'll be rich. And they never ask you again, I'll guarantee you. Well, just think, there are probably 10,000 AA meetings going on in the world right now, and you are the only one that could have helped you at that point. But I learned about other things. Later on, I got in another ship. I knew a little bit more. Then finally, I got to be 17. I went in the Navy, and then the Navy was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California. They were being sewed together, and they passed around some tests. I always been good on tests because I read a lot. And I did very well in this test. My dad's a teacher, and they gave me a high school diploma, which didn't seem like anything worthwhile, even what do I care? But it did shortly thereafter, because I went home after the war, and they allowed me to go to college. So I'm still a junior in high school. I was able to go to college with the first class of veterans, 1946, which was very fascinating when I look back at it. It just seemed normal at the time, but it was, unless you're old, you wouldn't remember it, but it was the one year of its kind in the whole history. For the first time ever, the last time ever, millions of people got out of the service all at once, and they all had the GI Bill, and they could all go to school. And many, many hundreds and thousands did. And they filled all the campuses. The colleges had to hire buildings and bring people in. And it just, everybody, the veterans had fun, everybody had fun. And you'd go to freshman English class, and there'd be some old 50-year-old ex-sergeant sitting there next to some little girl just out of high school. Were you in the war? Yeah. Do you put out? I fit right in. And I won some trophies. I found something I could do well, and I won some trophies in that university. I met this girl who, she seemed exotic to me. She had coal black hair and hard to find that Wisconsin black flashy eyes, and just seemed exotic. And she won my heart, and then she dropped the bomb. I'm a Catholic. I thought, I can't go to hell over that. And I fought against her, but she had me in her net. So we got married, and God, my grandmother went into a 2-year depression. Just, oh, Sonny, you're going to be so sorry. And I'm out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which to this day is my favorite job I ever had. And then my wife began to show the manifestations of Catholicism that I didn't know about, and that really changed my life significantly. There's something they never tell little Lutheran boys, or maybe they don't tell anybody, but if you marry a good Catholic girl, you're about to have a big family, whether you plan on it or budget for it or not. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just, boom. I remember talking to my wife and saying, can't we use birth control? She said, no. I think when I look back now, I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes, because it's hard to realize in this day and age of freedom how restricted everything was in those years. You know, when I was in college, after being in the service, I don't believe I still had ever heard the word condom. Maybe I had, but I don't recall it. The only contact you'd have is some real bad guy in a low bar might say something like, I got a rubber. And even these guys wouldn't dare go in and buy them, because you'd really have to find somebody really depraved, just nitwit depraved fool. And even they'd go in and they'd be ashamed. They'd say things like, give me some cigarettes. And some rubbers. Yeah. And that's what's so surprising today. After all these years, things have changed so much. At least in the Rite Aid drugstore by my house, these kids would say, hey, give me some condoms. And some cigarettes. Yeah. Well, I had to get better jobs. I got into advertising and public relations. I worked around the country, and I was very emotional. And that's considered a sign of creativity, at least to me. And I get good jobs, I have good city, get my job, and bring my wife and children in, and I get the job, push in the town, I wouldn't like the town anymore, and I get in a beef with somebody, or I drink too much, because all these years I drank and smoked and did all the things I ever wanted to do. And I get the beef, or lose the job, and go to the new town. I was a writer, I had good writing samples, and I could get jobs. And all these years, I look back now, and I realize now, and I've realized for some time since I've been in AA, what drinking meant to me then. At the time, it didn't mean anything to me, just something I did. But I can look back and see what drinking does for people like me. I can really get a feeling of, it seemed to me, I guess, for much of my life, and occasionally now, when I'm not feeling well, is that there's something missing in me. And I didn't know what it was. But I know that when people got close to me, they'd realize there was something missing in me and they wouldn't like me so well. So I'd keep them at a distance. I was at a distance. One, you get kind of lonely in there sometimes. So you have somebody get close and then they don't really like you after a while, so you get a turmoil. And it wasn't until I was sober for some time and listening to many inventories that I began to understand why I've traditionally
most of my life had difficulty in one-to-one relationships, especially in those years. And the reason was quite simple. When you got nothing going inside of you, when you feel not a great deal of self-worth, you must get your approval and worth from other people, not even being aware of it. So that even being aware of it, I fall into a series of demands on people that I seem close to. Not, the demand is always the same. I can see in retrospect. Just treat me special all the time. If you treat me special, I feel average. If you treat me average, I feel rejected. And there's nobody going to treat you special all the time. After a while, part of the acceptance is treating you normal. And when they start treating me normal, I knew they didn't like me anymore. Screw you, I didn't like you anyway. And on and on. And drinking changed that. When I drink, I feel like I'm enough. I feel like I'm more than enough. How you doing, baby? What a nice feeling after being a wussy all day to be something at night. Much of my life I've been bothered by fear, all kinds of fears. But one of the great fears is that people are going to see through me and see what a phony I am sometimes, and that I'm not hip and slick as I pretend to be, and all the things that go into that. And I just hate it. When I drink, I often become fearless. I fight cops. I jump off balconies into swimming pools. Don't have a swimming pool, I'll jump on your lawn. Shit, makes it to me, I just jump. And I, who cares? One of my great problems in my life, and it is for most people, are insecure. Feeling so sensitive all the time. Feeling so sensitive, especially in the way when feeling, I can, rejection. God, I can't, never could stand rejection. I can sense rejection when nobody else can see it. I can see it across the room. I can sense it in the air. And, I just, sometimes I hate to ask my wife to dance in those years. But I'm sober because she might say, oh, not now, I'm busy. I've discovered when I have a few drinks, it's all different. The best way I know to describe it, I must have said it 1,000 times, still the best way I know, I'm sure it's happened to guys in this room, sit at night, late at night in a bar, having a few drinks, thinking about how they're screwing you around down at work, brown nosers getting ahead. Men of integrity being held back. And as you drink, perhaps you notice a miracle slowly take place out of the corner of your eye. Some old beast gradually becomes beautiful. I might sidle over to such an old queen at closing time. Imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to join me in the old Chevy. If she would say, no, God, if I were sober, I'd just cut my wrist right there. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bother you. I didn't mean to. When I've had a few drinks, it's all different. I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch, don't come begging tomorrow. Well, what a nice thing drinking is for people like who need it. Sometimes I drink too much that I get, sometimes I act bizarrely, they say. So when I was still a kid, almost, 1949, I guess, some friends of my family said, can I see you get in trouble if you just do something about that drinking when you're drunk? There's this new thing in town called AA, apparently, where they can cut down on their drinking. So would you like to go to it? I said, sure. I went to AA in 1949, and about 10 old fools sitting around in a room with gray hair and burned out old boobs. I mean, I felt sorry for him, but Jesus, you know. I don't know what they said, but it seems, my memory is that they said things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never felt so goddamn happy. And even to dumb kids like me, there's a little credibility gap. There's something. Why don't you tell your face? You know. Well, I hung around AA for a while, and I left again. I went to AA again. Next year, I was working in a different city. The heat was on. From then on, when I drink too much, AA wasn't very well known. And so you could always tell employers, it had a nice mystique there. I'm going to try that new AA for my drinking. Good. That'll make it all right. So that'll give you at least a few weeks to discover where you're going to go next. And I gave you a little cushion. But mainly, I knew that my problem was not alcohol. it was when I'm drunk, but I'm not. It's not really alcohol. It's these other emotions and feelings of sadness and depression and remorse and regret and sensitivity. And I remember thinking, somehow or other, when I came off the assembly line, they were supposed to put some coating on me so I don't feel things quite so much. But somebody must have said, hey, God, you know, and I have all the emotions other people have, but they're just right on the surface. And people can destroy you in a sentence. You learn not to show it. Nah, what he said doesn't bother me. But a new name is on my kill list for the rest of my life. Son of a bitch, I'll kill him someday. And but drinking helped me get through a lot of things. And smoking, I'm great. Had a pretty good reputation for being intelligent and clever. And I went up and down different places. One day I went down, and I couldn't believe it. I went down and didn't come back up. And that can't happen to me, because I'm too slick. I was in Dallas, of all places. I'd been working there at a big advertising agency, and I went down, and within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, they repossessed my car. They asked me to leave the house I was in. My wife was up, I was off for a few days drinking, and she took the children, sold the furniture, and left with the children to go somewhere, I don't know. And all of a sudden, I'm standing in this empty house with my pile of clothes, and another close in on me, because I'm on parole from the state hospital, and they're going to be long now. And I thought, how can this be? But I knew I had to get out of there, so I don't know if they still do it, but then they used to have driveways where you could rent give an organization your car, and they'd move it to a city. And then if you were a driver looking to get to that city, you go out there and they'd give you a couple bucks for gas and you could drive the car as your own. So I got a car for Los Angeles. I got as far as El Paso and got drunk with some old friends. And got as far as Phoenix and got drunk and lost the car. I knew it had to be within a range of 100 bucks, but I couldn't find it. And I got cross and I was angry and some guy bumped me in the street corner. I said, God, that you. He says, take it easy. Take it easy. Sure. Turned to be a plainclothesman. Says, you need to get cooled off. And that was kind of cute because it was about 113 in Phoenix that day. And he threw me in jail overnight, which is, I've been in jail overnight a lot. And then in the middle of the night, I got so sick and I had to throw up. And I threw up and turned out, I threw up in a guy's bed. It wasn't the toilet like I thought. And he was gone, though. And I felt better. I laid down and went to sleep on the floor. And he came back and found his bed full of vomit and me laying next to it. You think that's funny? Wait till I get to the part where I get leukemia. You like that? And he just kicked me. He said, damn, you drunken bastard! And kicked my front teeth out. And, God, that was one of the few nights I've ever glad that I've been in psychoanalysis. I spent several $1,000 in psychoanalysis to find out the root of my problems. And I was glad I hadn't that morning because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember lying there thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything to make trouble. I got out of that jail the next morning. I didn't know what to do. I'd been in and out of AA for years, so I know that if you really get up against it, you're really drunk, go to an AA club and pretend to be a newcomer. Somebody will help you. You can do something. So I found the AA club there near downtown. I was staggered over there to an arid club and sat there, and some old lady said, are you sick? I went, hey, that's I am. I want to survive on an all-time basis, buddy. She said, what can I do for you? I said, well, I need a few nights lodging at the 12-step house. I could just have that, I could make the program. Oh, she certainly gave me some money. I run down the bus depot and got out of there as fast as I could. And got to Los Angeles. Didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. There was a guy in KFWB, radio station there named Ted Quillen, who was a big star at that time, and I'd given him a start years before. Not to see him, I looked terrible, but I said, Ted, I've been in a terrible accident. And I'm waiting for my insurance to take care of me. Geez, can you give me, and he gave me some money. He said, sure, Clancy. God, yes. And I drank and went around town. It was crazy places. I didn't know where I was going. And finally, I ran out of the door, and I came back to see him again. And I said, Ted, I need no more money. He said, you haven't had an accident, have you? You've become an old drunken bum. Get out of my station. Don't come back here. I was humiliated. And I was around, and somebody took me to the AA club. He said, maybe it's like some AA. I said, no. They dropped me off an AA club. And I gave them a ration of crap and went on with my business. And one morning, I found myself in a situation that a person of my background and intelligence and ability cannot be in. Two big guys were throwing me out of the midnight mission on Skid Row and saying, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. ads that I helped write. The old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that damn mission that morning, a cold drizzle, not much different than it is tonight, except it was raining, not raining so hard, but a cold drizzle. And I was sick. I had a terrible feeling. I look back, I know what that feeling is now, because I've seen people who come in AA after me identify. I couldn't identify. Because the feeling of not having a friendly direction. There's no place where if you go far enough, there's going to be somebody who's good and glad to see you. It's just no place to go. And you think, well, certainly on schedule, but I've seen that happen to people with a lot of dough. They burned everybody off. If some old guy came up to you that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to about 125 pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost your clothing. Must be in that car in Phoenix, wherever it is. But all you got left is what you got on. They're dirty and torn and wet. Even if you get some clothes, you can't get a job. You've got no front teeth. You've had such a mess. Your mouth is bloody and filthy. You're an only child, and your mother is not allowed to accept phone calls from you anymore because your stepfather is so tired of watching you manipulate her one more time for some money and make promises and break him and break her heart. He would rather have her think you were dead than the way you are. Now, you've been in and out of AA for a lot of years, being superior and smug and clever. Why don't you just go back to AA now one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it before you die? And if some guy had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, most people in this room who've been desperate know that honesty is not your number one priority. Priority is how do I get out of this or how to get them to leave me alone. But if I were in a mood to be honest, I would have probably had to say, pal, it isn't the way it looks. It isn't the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. And I'll tell you, I wish I were. I wish I would give anything. But I'm not an alcoholic. And he might have said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. And I couldn't have done that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and examine myself and delineate the changes. So I probably would have had to do what people like, frightened people like me do when they get cornered. You take refuge behind bluster. You say things like, oh, get out of my face. Screw you, son of a bitch. Leave me alone. I didn't know the right answer. I know the right answer now. I've known it for a lot of years. It's quite simple. I know what an alcoholic is. I'm not that. So that begs the question. Well, what's an alcoholic? Everybody in this room knows what an alcoholic is. People outside that won't come in here, that old fool sitting in the guard gate up there knows what an alcoholic is. Well, maybe him. I shouldn't have said that now. I'll make amends to him when I go by. I told him I was a speaker and he didn't care. Well, what's an alcoholic? Very simple. Alcoholics are people, you know, when they drink, they seem to have a lot of pain, and there are people ever so often who drink and they get in trouble in their lives, get painful, emotions out of whack. They come to AA, and somebody takes them to AA, and they clean up their act, they sober them up, clean up their act, and then they feel better after that. Isn't that true? You hear different specifics, the stories are all different, but the basic thrust is always the same. Oh, I drank a lot, I got a lot of trouble, I came to AA, and I cleaned up my act, and now I'm feeling better. Now it's the one thing I could never overcome in my life. I drink like an alcoholic. I've been in jail more than most alcoholics overnight, just things. I've been in a state hospital. I've been in a veterans hospital in a padded cell, briefly. But the one thing I know there's something wrong with me, no question about that. I've known there's something wrong with me since I was a little boy, and I've fought to disguise it. I don't exactly know what it is, but I want people to find out. But I know that it's not alcohol for a very simple reason. It is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And the longer I try to be good, the worse it gets sometimes. It's almost as though somebody puts a spring inside of me, and I just push it together little by little. And I just get more and more tense and more nervous. I want to do good, and I want to be good, and I just get the bad people screw me around. And I've gone to psychiatrists, and spent thousands of dollars to get rid of that feeling. I've read philosophy. I've done all sorts of things, changed cities. But I know there's nothing removes it quite like two or three drinks. And it gets rid of it. Now, so I drink.
And people think, oh, his problem is drinking. And they don't realize, I'm not a drinker. I'm a feeler. And I have to drink to stand it. But how do you explain that to anybody? You don't even know it yourself. And sometimes they get drunk again. And they say, oh, gee, you're drinking too much. You ought to go to AA. And you have to say, gee, thanks for the advice. But inside of you, a voice just wants to shriek, but you don't understand. Doesn't anybody understand, for Christ's sake? Doesn't anybody know? Where do I have to go to find someone to tell me what's wrong with me so I can do something about it? But nobody came up to me that morning. I just stood in the rain. And I remember this damn A club I'd been in. All I didn't remember anything about it, except I remember the streets I'm saying. I hadn't heard of either one of the streets. Fairfax and Wilshire. I said to some guy, where's Fairfax and Wilshire? He said, well, Wilshire is all the way through here. You have to go up Hill Street, over to Hill Street, cut over to Wilshire, then go west. And I did that. And I walked and walked and walked and walked and walked and walked in that rain. Years later, I counted my car. That's 72 long blocks. That's a long way to walk when you're sick and desperate. And a guy asked me one time in New York, how could you possibly walk so far when you were so desperate? And of course, the answer is quite simple. That's the only time you can. You could do it no other time unless you have to be terribly desperate. Then you can do whatever you got to do. And I saw this cabin and I felt embarrassed. I remembered it then. I'd been in there and made a fool of myself. And I had to get out of the rain. And they just went in there and they weren't glad to see me. And I wasn't glad to see them. And not only was it a club, but the worst type of AA club. It was full of AA fanatics. Jesus. I know nothing more depressing to an intelligent, non-alcoholic slipper than to have this wave of fanatics. Keep coming back. Read your book. Live and live. Then, ha ha, what do you mean? Get his book. And I hung around, and that night they had a meeting, and I had about 4 pounds of cake and listened to somebody talk about God or somebody I didn't like. And after the meeting, I didn't know where to sleep, and the guy said, there's an abandoned car out in the parking lot. An old Mercury guy named Joe Quinn left it here last summer. I said, are you trying to tell me I can sleep in an abandoned car? I said, yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah, thanks a lot, Carl. I really appreciate it. And I got the morning, next morning was Saturday. They had a spiritual meeting where they talked about Jesus or somebody, and I had about 4 pounds of cake, and then I found a little room on the third floor, not very many people knew about it, where they had a TV set. So I went up there and watched football games all afternoon. That was something. And they had a meeting that night, and I ate 4 pounds of cake, and they talked about success. And I went to bed in my car, got up the next morning and washed at the damn old club, and went upstairs and watched television, watched soap operas, and still raining, and this went on for days. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe my grandmother was right. Maybe this is what hell is, just having assholes tell me about AA 24 hours a day. I'm going to see how the signers did that word. Oh. Hey, I'm sorry I used that word. Some of you guys are rather young. And I had no idea that day or thereafter that would be my sobriety date, because I had no intention for it to be. Of all the times I ever got sober, that was the least time I ever wanted to stay sober, because staying sober to me is just beyond belief. I had stayed sober once in my life. I gave it all I had. I had a very good reason. You may wonder, if you have a good enough reason, can you stay sober? You can. I was in jail one night, just overnight, another carouse, and that was the wrong night to be in jail, because my son died that night. And I felt so terrible they found me, like he told me about it. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little son, and he died. And I couldn't stand it. I went to his little cast. I remember that weekend, just in my mind, my brothers-in-law came in, and my in-laws came in, and nobody said an unkind word to me. They just sat around the living room, but in their eyes, you could just see, you dirty son of a bitch. You, although they may not, because it wasn't, I think I could have done anything about it, but I felt it was. And I put my hand in his little casket. I said, John Emerson, this will never happen again. This will never happen again. I was working in Texas, and I got drinking a little bit, and then I got drinking out of the hand, and somebody pointed out to me, you're getting out of hand. So I said, that's right. I promised my son this wouldn't happen, and I stopped. And I stopped, and I felt ennobled by stopping. Boy, I'm going to stop, that's it. And you can stop for a while. But one day, eventually, one morning you wake up, and there's the spring, and away it starts. And I just got more and more tense. I didn't like the job. My children know I was doing it for. They're noise. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. Jesus, fuck daddy. Sorry. Daddy's sorry. Just that daddy has to feel good. I know I needed a few drinks badly, but I promised my dead son I couldn't drink. So what do you do then?
So one day when my wife took the children to Mass, I pulled the car in the garage and took the hose and the exhaust pipe and shut the car door and went to sleep and died. And a guy next door heard the motor running, noticed I didn't come out and walked over and found me dead, I guess, over the wheel and pulled me out and breathed my mouth and punched my heart and rushed me to the hospital and examined me, determined I was seriously emotionally ill and put me in a locked ward. And a week later, I was committed for an indefinite period, perhaps the rest of my life, to the state insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Now, that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's not really a big goal of mine, I'll tell you. I would still be there, except the next year they put in an alcoholic ward, the first one in the state of Texas. And by that time, I was able to feign being an alcoholic and got out as a recovered alcoholic. I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But that's, stopping drinking holds no pleasure for me. And I never had another drink. And I don't suppose anybody who ever slept as long as I did, 10 years, and been sober as long as I did, something over 40 years now, doesn't look back to think, what was different this time? God, what was different? Because not only for my own information, I'd like to be able to convey it to others. After all these years, people still send me long-term slippers from other cities on the bus. Go see Clancy. He's got, as though I got the magic answer. I don't have any magic answer. One couple of them sitting in this room tonight. I don't have any magic answer. I can communicate a little bit. And I've had some fortune. In fact, I was about 4 or 5 years sober. Remember, I really felt I had it. Because people pointed it out to me and I realized it's really true. I have the uncanny ability of talking slippers into sobriety. And I did it again and again. People brought me slippers from San Diego and Oceanside and other places. And it was like a miracle, except for one thing. Pretty soon something else appeared. I could not keep them in AA. They all left again. I couldn't imagine why. I give them the story why they should be here, what A can do, and they still drink. I couldn't, what's wrong with these people? And it wasn't until a few years later, I ran across an example of what it was that I see it so clearly now. In my back there, there's a driveway. One day I was teaching two of my grandsons, John and Joe Nutman, to ride a bicycle back there. And they were having a terrible time. They were falling down, and Joe cut his arm, and John had a bloody nose, and we don't want to do this anymore, Grandpa. Yes, you do. You just don't know it. I'm not going to have some kids make me look bad. The end of the day, they couldn't ride a bicycle. They were bleeding. Their mother whined at me. A couple of days later, I tried it briefly. They couldn't do it. And I thought, isn't that sad? After all I've gone through, to have two retarded grandsons. You know, just... I released them. I learned that from watching an Al-Anon wife. I just released them. And somebody else tried to help them, and pretty soon they were riding a bicycle. But what happened to those little rats? This happened to most of the people in this room. Is one day, out of nowhere, if you're learning to ride a bicycle, you fall down and you can't do it. But if you keep riding, one day out of nowhere, you suddenly get a sense of balance. You don't know how you get it. You can't explain it. But you can now ride a bicycle for the rest of your life, or a motorcycle, or whatever. But you cannot convey that ability to someone for whom you would give your life. Everybody's got to get on their own bicycle and fall off and try and some quit and so on. And in a much more complex way, I think that's the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. What we can do is put people on the bicycle. But if they don't pedal and steer and take an occasional fall and get up again, we can't help them. But all of us would have done that. That's one of the great things you learn about 12-step work. You have to get your ego out of the way. You must do the best you can in putting them on the bicycle. And not take it as a personal rejection if they fall off. Because that's no longer in your hands. You can tell them to make sure you tell them right. A couple of years ago, I was talking in Toronto. And a woman said to me, you know, in the afternoon, there was a question and answer meeting. And I love question and answer meetings if I'm doing answering. Because I've discovered I have a facility for weaving a tapestry of BS till I think of the answer. You know. And this woman in the back says, Clancy, I have a question for you. Yes? I want one of your long answers. She said, just in a sentence or two, what was different this time? And I could not think of an answer in a sentence or two. I could weave a tapestry, but I couldn't think of an answer. I said, I really can't give you that answer right now. I'm sorry. I was taking a shower that night before I spoke at the regular meeting, and I finally thought of an answer. But it was an answer I didn't like, because it's a two-bit little answer. It's a nothing answer. It's not the type of answer you want to talk about. I like answers that have panache with a little body. I'd like to have these new people tonight leave here and say, did you hear what Clancy said? Wet birds don't fly at night. Did you hear what Clancy said?
Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon. They mean nothing, but they give the newcomers hope. And the answer I thought of was such a petty little thing. This was the first time I ever sunk so low emotionally that I thought, ready? This is the first time I guess I do talk so much. Their four fingers get tired. I've had enough of this shit. This is the first time I ever sunk low enough emotionally to allow myself to take actions that I thought were stupid and I didn't agree with and I had no value for me whatsoever. And I took these dumb actions. I had never sunk that low before. I didn't even intend to take the actions, but I found myself surrounded by all these people. I look back and I think, what's the secret of why I stayed sober? I think one of the great reasons is this. I was surrounded by AA fanatics. I would not call them AA fanatics tonight. I would call them AA winners. You will hear again and again, new people, when you hang around AA, that old phrase, stick with the winners, stick with the winners. But who are the winners? They're not identified. They have a little badge, winner. You know? You think maybe the people who've been sober the longest. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. I know people who've been sober many years who used to be good AAs, and they just begin to atrophy inside. They become sour and bitter. And I tell newcomers to stay away from them, because all you're going to get from them is poison. They're staying sober, I don't know how. So who are the winners? Well, as far as I can tell, the winners are the people who sit in these meetings on a continuing basis, who came here feeling as bad as I did or you did. That's one of the hard things to come to understand, new people. We talk about all the things that happened to us, but you can only feel so bad. You can only feel so bad. And everybody in this room has felt as bad as they can feel, sooner, more than once, many times. But they've come here feeling bad, and in their desperation, they've allowed themselves to be guided to take actions that didn't necessarily make sense to them, and their lives gradually changed, they got a new perception, and now they sit in these meetings, they look for new people to try to guide into these same actions. Actions. Now they tell you to stay away from the losers. Well, who are the losers? Hard to tell. Sometimes they're fun people, they're effervescent people. But one, if you ever hear this, you know this person is a loser, and you stay away from them as far as you can. And it's such an innocuous little thing. They say things like, oh, you don't have to do all those things. You don't have to do those things your sponsor says. That's just BS. I don't do them when I'm sober. And they literally can kill people. Among the amends I had to make, I had some difficult amends, but the ones that were, I couldn't really do it, but I had to go back, tried to go back to this Alana Club in San Francisco and say, well, the three people I talked out of the meetings and getting drunk with me in 1955, if you're here, I'm sorry. Or back to the town's Logan Square group in Chicago. When I left here in 1951, those two guys and the girl, we went downstairs to Logan Square Lounge and got drunk, and I hope you've survived. You know, just, there's people here that are just lethal. I was one of them. But you stay with those people. And why do you want to stay with the winners? What's the purpose of staying with the winners? Because they are nearly always the activists. They are the ones taking the actions. And why do you want to take the actions? Because that's how you get better. I never knew that. But that's how you start to get better here. Not love, not surrender, not prayer. Oh, that's very nice. But our book clearly states, and I believe it to be absolutely correct, action is the magic word. And it's hard to understand that because it goes against your mind. All my life, I'm used to therapists, where therapists say, you come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change. And AA says, well, doesn't sound right, but you come to us, we will change your actions, and eventually your thinking will change. And it just sounds stupid until you stay here long enough to realize these people have hundreds of thousands and millions of sober people, and these people do not have any sober alcoholics. There's something, there's a moral there somewhere, I just can't make it out. But you stay with the winners because they are doing things, and if you're with them and you don't have much going for you, you just do what they do. Not because you want to, just what they do. You know? They all do it. When I remember about 5 weeks sober. One night I was thinking, somebody reminded me about this. Standing outside the 63 Heading Club, thinking, I'm not going to any more goddamn meetings. I'm so sick of them. They're going to Brent Goodnight and hear the rich people be so successful. Everything is wonderful. I've got to hold up a 7-Eleven or something and get some money, get some front teeth. get some clothes, get to New York, be something. I'm gonna die on this street. People in an abandoned car. I can't live like this. I just had it all in my mind, and I heard a guy say, "Come on, Clancy, get the car. We're all going to the meeting." Sunday morning, when I'm trying to rest, "Come on, Clancy, we're going to help Fred move his furniture." Oh, shit. And I hung around there, and I stayed sober, and I just made a friend of other losers, and we all hung in. And then the day comes where he said, "Get a sponsor." I had to get a sponsor. I don't like sponsors. I've had sponsors. If you're new to that, let me warn you. Sponsors have a terrible need to stick their nose in your business. I saw this guy used to be in and out of the club, and he was an actor. And he also played loving roles, uncles and cousins, same as Bob Bailey. Not a star, but a character actor. I thought, he's my man. Bob, would you be my sponsor? Yeah, I want you to do it. I'm going to try and tell you. Sure, Bob. I looked back at that and thought many times, he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played, because they were totally foreign to his nature. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. He just... And I've often thought, why would I take that crap? Because my stock and trade for much of my life, I don't take crap from anybody. On a job I work a year to get, somebody gives me a ration of shit. Take your job and shove it. I get in the bar, some of the guys say, "You ready to go?" "Yeah, I'm ready to go. Let's try it." May knock me down, but I don't take crap from anybody. And this guy was giving me a mouth of crap. And I took it. You know who I like? I like the kind of people I like. I like the people who like me. I thought they were stupid. I have no respect for them because they were dumb goals. But I liked them. I hated people who could see through me because they could see what a phony I was. And this guy could see through me, and I hated him. But he also liked me. I did things to get a pat on the back from that old guy I wouldn't have done for Jesus or my mother, nothing. Did a good job, big kid. And he gradually got me to take actions that I thought were stupid, and I did them. And I didn't. I stayed sober. I didn't do very well. I remember going to him one day, "Bob, you know, I'm living in an abandoned car. I'm living on cakes and donuts, man. Sometimes guys give me a hamburger. One guy, Jerry, what's his name, gives me an apple every once in a while. I says, 'Can you eat this? And I kill you, you bastard.' And he said, I said, 'Bob, I can't live like this. I'm living like an animal. What am I going to do?' He says, 'Get a job.' I said, 'Get a job? Look how terrible I look.' Says, 'You had a terrible job.' That was the first direction I really followed. And little by little, I stayed sober. Probably the biggest turning point from then on. There's a lot of millions of little turning points. One turn. When I was 6 months sober, a guy named Mike Ross got me a job as a dishwasher at the Gaiety Delicatessen. I got fired after 2 days for my attitude. And I walked out of there. I thought, I'd been staying at a guy's house, Jim, and his wife made me go back to get out of there because I'd been putting out cigarettes in their grug or something. Anyway, I was back in that abandoned car. I'd been for 2 days. And I'd go count on this money to get me out of this abandoned car. And I can't hold a job as a dishwasher at 6 months. And I used to be something. I might as well be dead. So I just decided to walk into the ocean. And I started towards the ocean. And I said, I'd lost my stamina. I couldn't find the ocean. I stopped at the gas station. I said, "Where's the ocean?" He said, "Well, you're in Western Beverly Hills. You have to go past the Veterans Hospital about another 3.5 or 4 miles after that." Screw that. I don't do that. So I called up my sponsor. I hate to call him because he hated to hear bad news. I told him, I said, "Bob, this is fancy. Why can't you work it?" "Bob, let me explain. You know, I'm just losing it, Bob. I can't go out anymore. What can I do?" He says, "Why can't you even go out? Why don't you?" About a week before that, I said, "Why don't you write your inventory?" I told him, "I've taken my inventory of the psychiatrist. Why do you want to take an out-of-work actor? What good is that going to do?" That made him cross. Everything made him cross. I said, "Bob, in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. My God, I'm so full of remorse and regret. Write down those things. I'll blow my head off. God, Bob, I need something deep with a meaning." And he explained that to me. He says, "In your judgment, who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it." I hung up on him. I punished him. And I came out of that, I was so mad, I came out of there, good thing I turned left. If I'd have turned right, I'd have been in the ocean, but I turned left. I got back to the A Club, I said, someone give me some place to run back inventory. And I wrote for about 2 hours. I put down things I would never told anybody. It's a dirty, petty mess. People used to say to me, why don't you tell us to your psychiatrist? Because if you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection, that's why. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. And I got done. I've got to do a lot. And I got done. I felt better. I'd proved it didn't work. That cheered me up a little. And a few days later, I was still around. And he came by with the club. He said, okay, get your inventory. I had to jam under the seat of my abandoned car. He said, get your inventory. We'll take your inventory. I said, Bob, I'm really not up for it. Let's do it next week or maybe the week after. My mortals wouldn't be right for it. I said, shut up, get in the car. So I get in the car. He drove from Santa Monica to Oxnard and he gave me a flashlight. And I read this thing. It was even worse after I read it. Jesus. And if he's going to make me get off in Oxnard, I'm going to have to walk 40 miles back to Santa Monica. Maybe be killed. I got up there and I got, that's all, Bob. Is that all the rest of it? Yeah. He restores it. That's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. I thought it was. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then, on the driver's side, with some other puke over there with a flashlight. Let me explain this part before I read it. That's the amazing thing. There are certain things in every inventory that are the same, every good inventory I've ever heard. They all are the same. They contain lack of self-worth, guilt, resentment, fear, and occasional lashing out at the world to punish them for what they've done to me. And the stories are all different. All over the. In 1 week, a few years ago, I heard a daughter of one of the most famous men of the 20th century. And a week later, I heard a guy just out of the Washington State Penitentiary, a guy from El Paso, born under a bridge, never knew his father was, just a low life his whole life. And their inventories were exactly the same. The specifics were all different. That's what makes AA so unusual. It works at a level you can't see it. That's why you can't depend on your judgment of whether or not you should do it. That's why you have to find to be with people who are doing it and do it and then discover after you've done it that it works. And it's that way all over. Now, I've been sober a lot of years and I've been active all these years, so I've had a chance to do a lot of things you people haven't had a chance to do yet. You know, in the last few years I've been asked to come and speak in places like Berlin and a few months ago in Dublin and Belfast and London and could be in Oslo again in June, and tomorrow I'm flying to Africa, speak all week in Africa, and on. You think you'd find exotic AA in all these places. You don't. Except for the accents, you hear the same chatter you hear right around here. Some people are afraid. Some people are trying to reassure them. Every group, in a sense, seems to boil down to the same thing. There's a group of people who have done the things who are feeling better. They seem to be here. There's a group of people who defy them, don't want to do the things, whatever the reasons are, don't want to go all the way, and they stand around and sneer and scorn at those people. And then there are the newcomers, and both these groups fight for their soul. And it happens all over. And it's amazing that we get as many as we do, because it's always to a new guy. It's easier to understand you don't have to do it than you have to do things you think are stupid. But that's why we reinforce ourselves. And I did that, and I stayed sober. And I finally got a job, and I was about 2 years sober as a little writer in the medical corporation. And I went to work every day, and I learned some great spiritual lessons from my sponsor. I'll share them with you now. You think, what are the great spiritual lessons of AA? Prayer, meditation. Yeah, they're nice. But let me tell you some real good ones. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. This lunch today, someone was saying to me, you're not going to actually drive all the way to San Diego in the rain all the way with the bad traffic. It didn't even enter my mind not to. If I did, my sponsor would come out of heaven and kill me. You know, you son of a bitch, I told you. But I mean, be where you said you were going to be, when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not coming. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, waiters and waitresses, employees, things like that. On days when you know you're having a bad day, watch that mouth. Because you can just cut people up and never even know it. Just being smart once too often. Ruin a friendship, destroy a friend. And a whole bunch of things. And I didn't learn the lessons very well, but I learned them well enough to know that I was able to stay in the job and eventually got front teeth when I was on that job. I still didn't have front teeth. I learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I went to work every day to get front teeth. I was 5 years sober. I was director of advertising for that medical corporation. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" I was about 10 years sober. I was downtown doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to a post office box in Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, and fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody bought me a metronome. It sure beats coitus interruptus or whatever that hideous torture is. And now they're all grown up, and three of those kids are in AA. They're all having 10 years this year. The rest of them aren't in AA because they're not alcoholics. I live in a house out by the ocean in West L.A. And a couple months ago I paid the last payment on a 30-year mortgage. Who would guess such a thing, for God's sakes? I live comfortably. I've held the same job I've held for 25 years. Jeffrey, which one is Jeffrey? You're the new guy? I'm going to tell you something that's going to make you feel a lot better. I've got it all together, and you haven't. But I know you'll be happy for me. See, that's what I... I just wanted to know where you were. I'm going to tell you something. All the things I've talked about up to now are absolutely true. In the next 5 minutes, I'm going to give you a 5-minute talk. Now, this was the introduction to a 5-minute talk. I'm going to talk to you, Jeffrey, and the rest of you new people. The rest of them can all go back to their meditations. How do you get out of here? The most important thing I said tonight, I said, my name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, when did I become an alcoholic? I was an alcoholic when I drank. I was an alcoholic when I got sober. When did I become an alcoholic? Because my problem has always been this. My problem is not really alcohol. It is when I'm drunk or raising hell and hungover, but it isn't really alcohol. And imagine my surprise to stay here a while doing dumb things with dumb people and taking dumb actions that enabled me to survive long enough to discover that is exactly what this book says. This book says specifically my problem isn't alcohol. And I've never seen it in there, but that's what it says. The problem is not alcohol. Now you might think, of course it's alcohol. We all know that. I can disprove that in 5 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. They don't. They turn out sober people. With varying amounts of information, what may be wrong with them, I'll guarantee you, if they be like me, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later, they will always eventually begin to drink again. The spring will hit. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what is it? Some sort of deep-seated mental neurosis they're not telling us about? We have to find out by videotapes or something? No. Everybody in this room knows what's wrong with them, but the new people may not know it yet. It is something called alcoholism. You say, well, that's the same thing, for Christ's sake. Alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Tremendously different. I could talk about that for 2 hours, but put it in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. Blah. But however, in alcoholism, this thing that to the naked eye looks almost exactly the same, this perception-distorting, mind-consuming, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. Sobriety always eventually gets worse than the drinking, and eventually you drink. You must have. Our book says there are times when you must drink to preserve your sanity. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. One other thing must be present. You must be one of the 6 or 7 or 8% of people who have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. which sounds nice except for one thing. Nobody ever knows they have an unnatural reaction to alcohol because they have nothing to compare it against. It's like eating a strawberries. I mean, does that taste unnatural to you? I don't know. Tastes like a strawberry. What the hell's unnatural? So what is this unnatural effect? Makes you stay drunk all the time? No, nobody can stay drunk all the time. They say they do, but they don't. Makes you act crazy. Some people do. Some people don't. I've seen people die who have not acted crazy yet. So what is this unusual, tremendous, unnatural reaction? It's something so simple I wouldn't have guessed it in 20,000 years of my own. Alcohol must have the unnatural ability to almost instantly make everything all right, to almost instantly release the spring. I think that isn't very much. It's much more than happens to anybody else. People who don't drink are not, or don't drink the way we do, are not necessarily superior to you mentally or morally. When they drink, they don't get that reaction. They get, as they often say, they get a warm feeling, a little fuzzy, maybe another drink makes them dizzy, so they don't drink it. And for you and I, the first drink starts to bring some life, and the second one after that starts to make everything all right. And that's why I will never know why I never could figure out why they didn't drink, and they could never figure out why I did. And eventually it's great, you come to depend on it. Alcohol is much better than narcotics. I know, I've been working with addicts for over 25 years. I know something about addicts. I'm not an addict. But I know about heroin, a great euphoria you get, but pretty soon you can't get there, so they have to take more and more heroin. Heroin addicts always die from overdoses trying to get back to a place they can't get to. And sometimes you'll volunteer to go into a hospital and get kicked through pain, and then so they can come back and get to that euphoria again. Cocaine gets you way up there. Omnipotent, it's just wonderful. But it's a speed drug, and the side effects of speed drug are always the same. Growing paranoia, growing discomfort, eventually terrible addiction. And all of a sudden, you have to get that like crack cocaine where you get a three-minute surge. And you got to get another three-minute surge. You just will kill to do it. And alcohol, it just changes you. And it makes it all right for a while. And one day you come to depend on it. But then if anything you come to depend on, event gets out of hand, but you got to stop. Then you realize, Jesus, pushing the alcohol is all this crap going on. So you got to drink. But you can't keep drinking, so you got to stop. And you can't stay stopped, so you got to drink. That's called alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, it's estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. I think it's safe to say a number of people in this room will die drunk. My sponsor who taught me that died drunk because he got mad at AA and stopped going around for a couple of years before they got him. And your mind tells you, you don't need this crap. And away you go. Now the reason I say that is because you understand what alcoholic is. That's why sitting here and learning things don't make any difference. It won't help you. You must take the actions. The purpose of AA is not to make you more and more sober. You're as sober as you'll ever be in 30 days. The purpose of AA is to little by little do what alcohol used to do fast. It takes people to feel like they're nothing and makes them feel like they're something most of the time. It takes people who live with fear, and I've become fearless much of the time. It takes people like me who are so sensitive to rejection I can't stand it. I still get rejected, but I don't think it's a conspiracy. I've just realized if you see where they're coming from and try to understand that, then you can pretty soon you can resolve it. And what happens is you start to live in a modified way, the way you dreamt to felt. But it takes a while. You got to keep doing it. And there's one other thing you got to do. There's some days in your life that's going to be terrible. Terrible days. Everybody's been sober over a week knows that. There are just some days when you get in the morning, by 10 o'clock, you know, there's no hope for this day. Everybody is an idiot. They should all be dead. But so you've got to watch your mouth. So you have to just think to yourself, come on, midnight. Come on, midnight. Right. And you got to say, but that's part of living, part of being a human being. And that's why I'm here. I want to say one more thing. Then I'm going to sit down. I know many of you got long drives to get home. But my strength will be up. I had some cold chicken. I got a chance to see Tom's beard just a little grayer than it was last year. Well, You old guys are ruining me. A number of years ago, or for many, many years, the worst disease, I've talked about this before, but I'd like to hear about it. The worst disease in the world, infectious disease, was smallpox. They cured the plague, they cured a lot of things, but they couldn't do smallpox. And it just wiped out cities. 1600s and 1700s, smallpox, nobody had no idea, but bacteria or germs, it just seemed like some hand of God coming down and getting them. I have a book home called Bring Out Your Dead, written about Philadelphia in the early 1700s, where they just go through the city with wagons and say, bring out your dead, and you bring out your mother to throw her on, or your baby, whoever it might be who's dead, and just no understanding. England, a guy named Dr. Jenner, Edward Jenner, a young doctor, he noticed something that seemed that didn't make sense. Girls who worked as milking cows, as cow milkers, didn't seem to get smallpox. Now, why the hell would that be? So he got looking into it, and he discovered, well, not exactly true. A lot of girls who milk cows got smallpox, but not if they'd had something called cowpox. If you had cowpox, they didn't get smallpox. Cowpox was kind of a relatively mild illness they got over with. And he could see no reason for it. As you said, there's no germs, no bacteria, no knowledge of anything. But he thought, I've got to see if this is true in some way to understand. And he bought a little boy named Jimmy Phipps. And he said, Jimmy Phipps, because of where the girls had cowpox. He didn't know how they transmitted disease. He figured it must be this way. Cut a little slit in his arm, took some pus off a girl's eye, and rubbed it in the arm. And little Jimmy Phipps got cowpox and got sick and got better. So he took him over to the pest house where they're dying of smallpox. And he cut. This time he used a knife because he didn't want to touch this terrible stuff and the blood and pus off a dying woman, and rubbed it in Jimmy Phipps' arm. And Jimmy Phipps got sick and got better. And for the first time they realized, and no way they could tell why, but if you got cowpox, you wouldn't get smallpox. And so from then on, they tried to talk people into getting cowpox. So some people would, some people wouldn't, because it's all superstition. Here's an interesting little thought. The word for cow in Latin is vacus. That's where the word vaccination comes from, injection of the cow. And 150 years later, they finally discovered why it worked. They finally discovered bacteria, microbes, disease concept. They discovered through microscopes that cowpox sets up a series of antibodies in the blood which stop the smallpox bacilli, but they didn't know at the time. And the reason I think about that sometimes, I think sometimes we hear an AA people say, newcomers will say, how does AA work? We have a very slick answer to that. How does it work? Here's how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail. But that's not the answer. What they're saying is, why does it work? And nobody knows why it works. That's what you do, but why does it work? We're very similar to Dr. Jenner, you know, and maybe 100 years from now, some scientist somewhere, maybe out in El Cajon, or some other advanced intellectual place. We'll make it quicker. I've discovered it. I've discovered the reasons. A series of apparently inane actions taken in a certain order under the direction of a dictatorial guide somehow sets up a flood of something to the cerebral cortex, making it unnecessary to drink. Yeah, yeah, we've got the answer. But we won't be around to see it. We'll all be dead. So we're kind of screwed. So we've got to tell you, Jeffrey, and all the other new people here, we're much like Dr. Jenner. You've got to take it on faith. I can tell you the people here that have got cowpox are not getting smallpox. So we can't tell you why, but you just get a sponsor. Take the cowpox,